what do you think if I get one of these to my wife? And she said, absolutely not.
It's early in the year, but this might be my favorite car of the year already.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Classics World Chat Show, a chance for us to spend half an hour or so blithering on about old cars. So welcome along for our journey. And I'm joined with Jeff Ruggles.
Hello.
And Joe Miller.
Hello.
Okay, chaps. Well, let's crack on. It's been a busy week in the news. Classic car buyer has just gone off to the printers, so we can talk wax lyrical about the 20th of May issue. So, Jeff, over to you. What's the front page of next week's issue of Classic Car Buyer?
We're inspired this week by some news from overseas, actually. One of our contributors, Craig Cheatham, went over to the, and I've got to get this pronunciation right here, the A.M. Walhalla show in, hang on a minute, Ramdonksveer, now I've definitely got that wrong, in the Netherlands, which is basically a sort of Dutch equivalent of the Festival of the Unexceptional. And this is newsworthy because it's growing in popularity. So over 1,100 cars there this year. It first started in 2018, and it's ever since COVID, it's got bigger and bigger every year. I think there was about 40 cars that went over from the UK as well. So really interesting there. And it sort of kind of fits with this theme, you know, photos bigger and bigger every year. And you've got events like Rustival. Some of our Tatton Park shows have lots of bread and butter classics involved. You've got places like Bewley having, I had one of those exhibitions, you know, this sort of dedication to the unexceptional, more ordinary vehicles.
I love it.
It's that street furniture, isn't it, that we remember when we were growing up?
Yes.
That sold in lots of numbers when they were new, but haven't survived. So actually, they're now probably rarer than some of the exotica that we see at other shows.
I like the rise of these kind of humbler car shows, because the thing is, everyone has the posters of supercars on the wall. Now, I mean, you'll see in an upcoming Our Class of 76 video, and Paul makes a very good point in that video. It's like, he remembers being ferried around in a Mark 1 Fiesta. He doesn't remember being ferried around in a Lotus Esprit. And actually, the cars that you saw on the street, they're the ones you've got the nostalgia and the memories for, which makes sense why there's such a growing following for it. And I think it's brilliant, because it's more relatable, like you say.
Wait, there's absolutely nothing wrong, don't get me wrong, there's absolutely nothing wrong with loving an E-Type and being part of the E-Type Club and doing all that. That's brilliant. But this show was just, I mean, I think in the pictures I saw three Mark 1 Seat Ibizas.
Blimey, that's got to be awesome, surely.
Not even sure there are three in the UK. There's certainly no registered Malagas, I don't think.
Well, so, didn't Craig Cheatham go over in a Peugeot 309 or something? But quite
he did,
an early
a diesel.
One
yeah, an early 309 diesel. And I think he lined up with another load of things as well. So a real celebration of, like you say, former street furniture. And I just thought, I want to go next year, basically, is what I'm trying to swing.
I think we should totally make that happen, because, like you say, there's Festival of the Unexceptional with Haggerty that happens in July, I think, and this is sort of a European equivalent of that and wherever. And so it's great that they're being protected.
There's scope for us to do some sort of unexceptional cars road trip, because you've got your Mini City, Jeff. Phil, you've got a Rover 213 on steel wheels, and I've got an absolutely Billy base spec Mercedes 200. So there's an unexceptional road trip in the making there, surely.
Yeah, although back in 1984, you'd have been quite the man about town if your Mercedes, I think.
With my windy-uppy windows and my steel wheels.
Oh, that would have been very much the accountant's or bank manager's choice, I think. So you were probably more...
I need to get some red braces to go with it. I've got a brief bit of news, gentlemen, which, as you're listening to this and watching it as it comes out, is less than 48 hours ago, so you've probably heard it by now. But anyway, the long-awaited and still very much awaited and slightly controversial new Jaguar, the electric four-door, as we understand it, thing over £100,000 Tesla rival, whatever it's going to be, they have named it, and they have not named it in quite the traditional sense, because they've decided it's going to be called Type 01. That's going to be the official name. And Jaguar's definition is that zero is because it's a new chapter for Jaguar. It's like nothing that's come before, so it's zero, and then one is because it's the first of them.
No hyphen pace or hyphen type. We've gone for type hyphen 01.
It's a very interesting move, isn't it? Because they were criticized with the new ad campaign.
Everything.
Yeah, they were criticized with the new ad campaign for basically dispensing with the heritage. And they deleted a lot of the heritage stuff.
They wiped it clean,
from their website. Basically wiped it clean, as you say. And then there's been the kind of a little bit of a regression into celebrating that heritage. And now it seems obviously the name is a clean break. So it's an interesting one.
The problem is the whole thing has been so dragged out now that
it feels like no matter how good this car is when it comes out and what it turns out to be, it can't possibly live up to the hype behind it.
I think they've got, unfortunately, I think they've got a real challenge on their hands. And, you know, everyone knows how much of a fan I am of the Jaguar Mark and how I really want it to succeed. But it's just been a very long, drawn out, protracted relaunch, hasn't it? Which has not gone smoothly, whichever way you want to cut it. And it's fascinating when you revisit, they basically stopped making cars entirely. Then they've tried to sell us this new vision, which was bold, and you could argue they've got nothing to lose. They, you know, the conventional approach hadn't worked, or they weren't managing to tackle Audi and BMW and Mercedes on a level playing field. So try something radical. But in the 2 years or so that's happened, we've seen a sort of a dilution, I think, of that electrification journey that certainly Europe is going through.
The fantastic advert they did where they've kind of honored a bit of heritage, where you can see the new car with a C-type and a D-type and an E-type and an XJS and whatever behind it. The thing that offended me most was the fact that the XJS had federal headlights on it. And frankly, I switched off since I saw, honestly, they are horrendous. But
I quite like the federal headlights.
Well, thanks very much for watching. We'll see you again soon. I read something online. The amount of people that have gone, just keep making supercharged V8s. That's what we want. Like, yeah, but no one was buying them. So clearly that's not what people wanted. You know, you have to remember, we as petrol heads represent a very small sector of the car buying market. And the sector of us that can afford to buy a £100,000 5-litre V8 is even smaller. So suddenly our very vocal opinion doesn't necessarily count for all that much.
And don't forget, the Ferraris and the Lamborghinis of this world have also, and Porsche, have made money out of selling SUVs. And to some extent, Jaguar are a little bit fenced in by that because Land Rover was doing the SUV thing. So although they had the F-Pace and the E-Pace, they were arguably not what Jaguar was synonymous with. But I really hope it works. But the sort of row back and forth with copy nothing, but actually let's invite loads of journalists to Gaydon to try out the prototype alongside all the heritage, suggests that they've had a second thought about they maybe should pay reference to the heritage, because it's what Jaguar has over any of the emerging Chinese car makers. It's as simple as that.
So I'll tell you what, here's an interesting one for you, gentlemen. Readers, also viewers and listeners, why don't you comment down below what you think of the way Jaguar is going? Because I'm sure that will open the floodgates.
Let's do it. It'd be very, very interesting to hear everyone's comments, or perhaps there's a favourite Jaguar that you can think of that you think best represents the Mark in its glory days.
To be honest, I think I'd rather have a Seat Ibiza Mark 1.
Yeah, I probably would, actually.
Engineered by Porsche, wasn't it? Didn't it say that on the engine?
Yeah, it's in Porsche. Yes.
And now, gentlemen, it's also very exciting because today is the on-sale date of the June 26 issue of Classics World magazine. So a lot of you might know us for videos and now podcasts, but there is still this traditional mysterious thing called a print magazine that's still around every month. So the June issue is out today, and we've got the cover feature of Sports Cars for £20,000-ish, and a Triumph TR6 is our representative. You can actually probably get them for quite a bit less than £20,000, but there's all manner of cars in here. Austin Healey Sprite, I see, is mentioned. MGA, Lotus Elan, Datsun 240Z. There's quite a lot of nice sports cars for your money here. Lots of inspiration from diehard classics to things like the 996, 911 and the TVR Camaro, which I know is a firm favourite of yours, Joe.
It is. You're listening to the world's greatest TVR Camaro and 205 GTI podcast, after all.
Yes. So there's lots of cool stuff in the latest issue of Classics World. It's on sale today. You can buy an issue online or go down to your local newsagents and pick it up. Or, of course, you can subscribe, and I'll hopefully Joe can put the necessary links in the description so you can have a look at that later.
I've got my copy landed in my letterbox this morning, so yes, I'll be reading that myself.
And this week we've also reviewed the Classic Ford Show, which took place last Sunday at the South of England Showground. I loved wandering around. The weather was a little bit unkind, but again, the collection of cars was fantastic. I thought it was superb. Yeah.
I thought the vibe was lovely in spite of the weather, because that show is normally like our summer fair where it's 30 degrees and we're all in shorts. The weather was not on our side, and you can't help that, sadly. We didn't get next day delivery for the sun that day. But the actual vibe was still really nice. It was still nice and busy. And I've said this before, I think it's the highest standard of cars of any of our shows. The great unveiling cars were something else this year. I think they were the highest standard they've been. Yeah, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And again, I always say I'm not a Ford guy, but I came away with at least a dozen cars. I'm thinking, I'd have that.
If you do like the medium of print, the Classic Car Buyer has a Classic Ford show report next week.
And a Mark 1 Mondeo road test if you can't get enough Ford action out of that one.
Well, yes, there is. There we go. Blue oval heaven for sure. Fantastic. Now, I'm going to move away from Fords and all things newsy, because it occurred to me that it's been over 50 years now since British Leyland as was nationalised. It was nationalised in 1975. And I believe that the privatisation of said organisation was about 40 years ago, or certainly the repurposing of the brand to become Austin Rover in 1986, so 40 years ago. So we all love the tragic tale of woe that is British Leyland, and I'm sure we could all have we could spend an entire podcast talking about the highs and the many lows of the British car industry. But I thought it'd be good to sort of throw it out there as to, was British Leyland the disaster that everyone thinks it is? There were definitely glimmers of hope and inspiration in there amongst all the kind of the backdrop of strikes and disruption and poor quality and all those kind of things. I don't think it was as much of a disaster as perhaps we always like to think of it. So I'd like to throw that back to you two to discuss that. But also, let's pick three of our favourite cars from that BL era. Any budget, just three of your favourite cars. So, I mean, Jeff, you're as a mini apologist, you're probably quite well placed to talk about the British car.
Yes.
So was British Leyland the absolute nadir of our car industry? Was it the sort of the beginning of the end, or even the end of the end for the British car industry as we knew it?
You could argue that BL had a very good knack of sort of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Yes, I think that's true.
I think they, because the products, obviously they get a bad press, weren't all bad, let's be honest. They weren't.
No.
They weren't all bad at all. And they were always improved when they had a bad start. A lot of BL's issues and BMC before that was almost having the first cars as guinea pigs, really, and then having that reputation soiled almost straight away, and then sorting them out. I mean, it even happened with the Mini, to be honest, although it's kind of saved by the fact it went around corners better than anything else. But a lot of their cars, you know, the Marina, some of the road testers complained about the handling. Similar happened with the Allegro Ride, you know, the Rover SD1 even. Yeah, you can reel off a list of them. But actually, after time, a lot of those cars were improved and were pretty competent.
So would BL have survived if those cars had been right from day one, or was the problem deeper than that?
Well, the fact that it had to be sort of rescued by the government suggests that there were deeper issues.
Oh, I was gonna sort of throw to you that I think what I would argue is that the peak was the 60s, which then potentially led to some complacency that then they never managed to shake. So, I mean, you know, as the younger member of the team, what's your take?
You can make some case for that. I mean, what I find interesting is the amount of videos we've done on BMC and Leyland cars where I've included a title that infers the missed potential. You know, like, so the MGC is the nearly perfect sports car, and the Land Crab was so near and so far, and the Leyland Princess was nearly brilliant, you know, and so many cars that were on the cusp of absolute brilliance and they didn't quite get there because of the red tape in the background, or because of financial issues, or because of quality issues. And what I think was very telling was that there's a book I can highly recommend people read, published by the Rover 200-400 Club, called The Viking and the Samurai. And it's written by John Backus, who was the head of the Honda Rover collaboration in the late 80s. And he tells it from his point of view. And he talks about when the Triumph Acclaim came along, and how that was the lowest warranty claims they'd ever had, and the quality was impeccable. In our Marina versus Acclaim video, I make mention of it. And he says something along the lines of, the factory workers were shocked by how good, like they said, it's impossible to build this car wrong. And it was the kind of practices that they just weren't used to. So I don't think BL's core products were bad. I think a lot of them were very, I mean, we've said before, the Marina is an awful lot better than it gets credit for. The Allegro is a genuinely decent car. The Princess is a charming thing. I really like those. I don't think the core product was at fault, but I think everything surrounding it was at fault. Put it this way, you can have a really nice kitchen in your house, but if it's built on the edge of a hill that it's falling off of, it doesn't really matter how nice the kitchen is. So
I think you make a good point, Joe, because actually I don't think it was complacency. I think it was, they were actually quite innovative. They tried to introduce features in these cars, you know, hydrogas suspension, five-speed gearboxes, you know, the maxi with it, all of its with the hatchback and all of its space. There was, when Ford were playing it safe at the time, Ford, you know, and that was why Ford's appealed at the time, actually, because they were safe for fleet buyers and things like that. And stuff like the AD016 was more complicated.
I'm not knocking the innovation, because as you said, the products themselves were bad. I think where the complacency potentially lay with pricing, with the manufacturing facilities, you know, I think there's that story, isn't there, when Ford bought Jaguar and they walked into Brown's Lane for the first time. They thought it was some sort of third world sort of Russian outback factory or something. It was so deprived of upgrades and investment to make it a modern production facility. And of course, when Nissan built their new factory up in the Northeast, they could start from scratch and build it with all new production practices in mind. Whereas, you know, the Browns Lane factory, it was, you know, a product of a pre-war era built and developed in the early 50s. And probably money was spent on it in the 30 years thereafter.
I think, to keep my house analogy going, it's a bit like when you've got an old rundown farmhouse or something, and it's like, well, yes, it's very pretty, but also the beams are rotten and the foundations are falling apart and blah blah blah. And more often than not, it makes more economical sense to bulldoze it and start again, whether people want to do that or not. And I think you can see that with BL, is when they brought in the Honda facilities to build the Acclaim, suddenly, oh my god, we can make good cars, you know. So it, like you say, it almost needed to be clean slate, start again with that modernity built in.
Yeah, but they were always trying to work with one hand tied behind their back, weren't they? Because the Mini was brilliant, innovative, changed the game, but is widely believed to have made a loss.
Yeah.
And so you're always fighting this kind of financial pressures, which means they couldn't upgrade, and they're sort of stuck then between wanting to make a competitive, forward-thinking product, but also having no money to do it. And that's nationalization.
But without wanting to risk asking a really silly, potentially obvious question, if it was losing money, £590 or how much it was selling for, why not sell it for £600? Do you know what I mean? Like, if to make it profitable, sell it at £650, why not sell it at £650? And if it's not profitable at that price and it won't sell at that price, then you're on a lost cause anyway.
All the whole British Leyland BMC story proves is that Britain, as ever, we are fantastic designers, we are fantastic engineers, we are not very good accountants.
Yes, I think that probably is a safe assumption. But listen, let's move on to the cars themselves, because as we've said, there was never anything wrong with the product. The cars themselves, fundamentally, as concepts, were very good. Their execution may have been flawed. So let's go to our three favourite BL offerings. So, Jeff, what's your first one on your list?
I'm going to start fairly predictably with a Mini, because I am two of this
my word
model. Yes, and it's a car that's had a kind of role reversal, and I like it for that, and it's the Mini 1275 GT. And when it came out, it was always seen as, you know, the poor replacement for the Cooper, because Donald Stokes didn't want to pay John Cooper his £2 royalty on each car, and it had a much sort of pared down spec. You know, it was pretty much 15 horsepower down on the Cooper S. But it's always remembered quite unfairly, because it didn't directly replace the Cooper S, it replaced the Cooper.
Mm.
And in comparison with the Cooper, the 998cc Cooper, it had a bit more power, more equipment. You know, you could get to the distributor a bit easier because it had the Clubman front. You know, it had funky stripes, rust-style wheels. And I think those early ones are really cool.
Yeah, definitely.
But for probably much of the 80s and 90s, they were seen as the poor relation to the Cooper, and certainly the Cooper S.
And so, I think that's why I like them the most, actually.
They were giveaway cars.
Slightly underdoggy, aren't they?
Yeah, they're slightly. And yet, that's all turned around now. You know, you can pay as much for an early 1275 GT as you can for a Cooper S of the same era. Actually, owning one has always kind of eluded me. I own two, but I've never driven either of them more than about 50 miles. So I've had one since 2005, which is still being restored. Please this year. And I've got another one which I bought as an easier restoration in 2008, which I drove for a restoration and discovered it was extremely rotten. But it's a really early car with the hydroelastic suspension and really nice bits. So that's been waiting in the back of the unit for the sort of when I get round it pile. Yeah.
Well, one day, hold on to that dream. You need to champion that underdog for us. So go on in, Joe. What's your first BL car?
From the humble and the modest Mini, I'm going for the most extravagant, excessive, wild, ridiculous car, arguably, that British Leyland ever made. It's one of my dream cars, and I will always be an apologist for it, and that is the Jaguar XJS. Because we've always said, I'll keep it brief, but the E-Type was a hard act to follow, and I don't think any car that came after the E-Type was going to be that well received. And the XJS has its flaws. You know, the early V12 cars are single-figure MPG. The quality's not great. Practicality-wise, go and watch our Living with an XJS video. They are dreadful. There's no room in them. The ergonomics are awful. You can't see out of them. And yet, for me, they are drop-dead gorgeous, particularly as a coupe, and they've got a character like no other car. I just think they are the most charismatic, wonderful car. And if I had all the space and money in the world, I'd 100% have one. I love them.
Do you know what? Just to bring it back to what we started talking about at the top of the podcast, the maybe the Jaguar Type 01 is trying to channel some of that trailblazing spirit of the XJS. Like, no one had seen the XJS before in 1975, and people did balk at it and think, what the hell's this? This is no E-Type. But actually, yeah, all those years on, 50 years on, we are still looking at the XJS and going, wow, that is amazing. Yeah. It's a cool car.
As long as they don't put federal headlights on the new one, I'm not fussed. Go on, sir. I've nicked you to the Jaguar spot there. What's your first choice?
Yeah, you really have, haven't you? So I'll leave my Jaguar choice, and there is one people will be pleased to hear. But I'm going to go with the Princess.
The of course.
Leyland Princess, whatever it is, Austin, Morris, Wolseley, as it started life as and quickly became just the Princess. We did a video on it. It's one of the better performing videos on the channel, actually. I have childhood memories of being taken to school in one. And I've always liked the look of them. I kind of admire their, again, underdog spirit that's very typical of a British Leyland product. It was slightly dogged with reliability issues and supply issues through strike action and so on. But again, fundamentally, a really lovely car. And actually, then they tried to right some of the wrongs by making it a hatchback with the Ambassador. And actually, I think it was a worse car for it. So, yes, very much one of my favorite cars, a kind of proper what might have been story, because I think that definitely had the gumption to take on some of the best stuff from Citroen or Audi or something like that as a kind of left field
choice. Real misunderstood genius, that car.
Yeah, absolutely. Go on in, Jeff. Next one from you.
I thought long and hard about a next one, but it would have to be, I'm sticking with the small cars here, sorry everybody, a Metro. I originally thought MG Metro, but actually, if I was really specific, I would want an early 1300S, which was the initial performance model, launched in as part of the launch range in 1980, which only then lasted until 82, I believe, early 82.
Lovely.
No, good choice with the Metro.
It was a British car to beat the world, and it initially sold really, really well, didn't it? It was in sort of the top three of the sales charts for those early years. And it was kind of another one of those Leyland cars that wasn't developed as quickly as it possibly should have been, and then started to lag behind a little bit. But let's face it,
again, that's a familiar BL story. You launch a car that's kind of 7 or 8 out of 10, so it's competitive, broadly competitive at the time of launch, but it probably needed a facelift, a substantial one, by 1983 to bring in a 5-speed gearbox and things like that. But none of that happened until 1990, you know, when you've got a more competitive 16-valve engine and a 5-speed gearbox. So go on then, choice number two, Joe. What's follow that one?
I'm following up my big, thirsty, stylish GT with the second one. One of the most infamous BL failures, I suppose, the Triumph Stag. I'm a big fan of the Stag. I think this was a car that had everything going for it. Gorgeous Italian styling, a lovely V8 engine with the most beautiful noise, a genuine four-seater, proper GT to rival the Mercedes SL. And for want of some very poor design decisions, it flopped. And it's known as a failure, or a lot of people remember it as a failure. And for those of you that don't know about why it overheats, we've done a whole video on the channel because there's so many different points in that car or in that engine, which makes it so badly flawed about why it overheats and why it gives all these problems. But on a good day, a nice one is wonderful. They're fast and they're comfortable. And they, again, fantastic character. And it is yet another telltale of all the problems in the background of BL, because the Rover V8 could have gone in. And it could have worked, and people subsequently put them in to prove how well it worked. But Triumph were too proud of their efforts developing their own V8 to let that happen. So they claimed it wouldn't fit, which again, did that hamstrung the Stag to the point where it failed? P- potentially. But what that means is that if you enjoy a good one today, it is a fabulous car. They're just lovely.
Yeah. I've always liked them as well.
The knowledge now exists, doesn't it, to make sure that those cars are reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they look great. Go on then, Mr. Whedon. What's choice number two from you?
Well, I'm going to keep you in suspense for my Jaguar choice because I'm going to follow your lead with Triumph. Oh, my God, this is, if you want to sort of a problem child of the BL era, it's this, because it was built in three separate factories in a very short space of time. It's the Triumph TR7, a sort of problematic gestation period and subsequent on sale where it kind of starts life. It was meant to be a convertible, but then they bottled it and made it just a fixed head, and then they brought out the convertible later. But I think it looks fabulous. The engine is a bit rough and ready, but it was got a decent turn of speed. I could see someone bringing out a kind of a resto mod TR7, you know, a slightly better quality interior. You take that fundamental shape of the fascia and just put modern materials with it, and that would pass muster today. It would pass as a modern car. I think that's how forward thinking it was, despite it now being a 50-year-old design. So I just think it's fabulous. I'd go the Roadster. I wouldn't get the fixed head, actually. I think the Roadster's the prettier car.
Agreed.
I think they're fabulous. So yes, that's my second choice.
I'd have a fixed head one, just to be different.
Ooh, controversial.
Each to their own, that's fine. Very good. What's your third choice, Jeff?
Okay. So I've been quite niche with the 1275 GT, haven't I? Picking a model of a model.
Mm.
And I'm about to get even more niche because last week, well, for this week's issue, we included a feature on special editions that were a little bit special. And one of the ones that were included was, you know, was actually a flop. The car was a flop, but it's kind of gained a notoriety. And now I'd love one if there are any left. And that's the Austin Allegro Equipe, which was the run-out model for the Series 2 cars. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was a 1750 in silver with honking great Starsky and Hutch-style stripes down the side in various different colours. The most eye-catching stripes ever. I mean, this was kind of, I suppose, picture some kind of Golf GTI rival, but yeah, it didn't sell well. I remember seeing one on my way to primary school back, must have been in the early 90s, and thinking, what on earth is that? And I think it's just sort of been ingrained in the mind. It's just a crazy, crazy thing. I mean, just those stripes, the big front spoiler, the alloy wheels that were supposedly porous, and the tyres would go down. You almost can't believe it existed, and therefore you want one.
You've got to admire the sort of ingenuity / desperation that comes with a car like that, isn't it? You're really trying to flog a bit of a dead horse by then. But
I love how wacky it is. Like you say, on paper, it makes no sense at all. It's almost like someone's fed a picture of an Allegro into AI and gone, draw a sporty one. You know, it doesn't look real. I think again, between that and the Vanden Plash, you've got two Allegros that probably shouldn't have existed, but I'm so glad they did.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly that.
So go on then, Joe, you're going to top that with your third and final choice, sir.
I am, yes, because I think, and I'm going to get some flack for this, I know I am, I think I can say this is the best car, objectively, that British Leyland ever made. And I think it is proof that there was the capability within the company. And if every car they built had been this good, they might well still be with us today in some form or another. And that is the Triumph Acclaim.
Very good.
Because
you mean the Honda doesn't?
yes, the Honda Ballard. Because as we've said very recently in our Marina and Acclaim video, suddenly it was a car that wasn't exciting, wasn't stylish, but it was well-built, it was reliable, it was dependable, it was practical, journalists loved it, the buying public bought it in their thousands, and a lot of them went back and bought another one because they loved it so much, and they couldn't believe how low the warranty claims were on it, because when they're actually screwed together properly and worked, they, funnily enough, didn't get brought back as a car, objectively, to show the company was capable of making something good. It's surely at the top of the tree. They're brilliant. It's a fabulous car, and I drove that red one we did for that video recently. I was like, these are still really good, and it feels really lively, and yeah, they're a great car to drive in their own right, but also, as proof that the company was capable of something good, the Triumph Acclaim is right up there. I think they're brilliant.
Yeah, it's
very
a good
controversial.
Choice.
I suspect I may get some flack in the comments for that one.
I think you've got to look at the place that had in the sort of Rover timeline. Signing that deal led to cars like the R8, which is, you know, a fantastic car. You know, we all like the R8.
The bridge between the old traumatic BL era and the perhaps more modern Austin Rover / Rover era it was the car, wasn't it? It's the one that bridged that gap perfectly between the two worlds. So my third and final choice of my BL hero is actually a car that sort of came out kind of arguably after BL, but I know it started its development time during the BL era, and that's the Jaguar XJ40.
Which is
40 years old this year. It was meant to come out in 83, I think. And even then, I think that was later than I think they wanted to. I mean, the reason the Series 3 exists is because the development of the XJ replacement was so behind schedule. That alone marks it as a standout car for me because it was so bedraggled and protracted as a car to actually even come out. It was actually a commercial success when it did finally enter the market, albeit that those quality issues that delayed it in the first place still hadn't been properly resolved. So those first 2 or 3 years when it was selling brilliantly probably came back to haunt them because it was, you know, problematic. So they had to hurriedly facelift it. Of course, it then transcends into Ford ownership because Ford bought Jaguar in 1989 into 1990. So, you know, you've got, you know, the XJ40 then straddles that era. So if you think about it, the Jaguar XJ40 was conceived in the BL era, launched in the Austin Rover Jaguar Independent era, and was still on sale, and arguably got to how it should have been at launch during the Ford era. So it spans three eras of Jaguar ownership, which I think makes it kind of unique in itself. I've owned a couple, and I would happily own another one. I think it's great. I think the styling is much maligned, but actually I quite like the wedgy style, or sort of the blocky styling of the XJ40. So yes, that's my third and final BL hero, as it were. But
almost as cool as an Allegro.
Almost as cool, not quite. No, it's not a key. Jeff, you always say you're always tinkering or something. Is there any car shenanigans coming up?
Well, I'm putting up a garden fence, so that's not much to do with the car. But there will be, I'm trying to get the Mini that I recently bought back on the road after a bit of a refresh. So I'll be looking at that over the weekend.
Very good. What about you, Joe?
So I did something which was quite therapeutic in a way, which is I went around both my cars and I got a little note on my phone and I just went around and picked, not literally picked holes, I don't think there's any rust, but I went around and picked up anything that needed doing. So little things like on the Fiat, I need to paint a door handle and it needs a brake light bulb. And on the Mercedes, I need to reattach a bit of trim that's come off. You know, the little tiny things. There's nothing overwhelming, but it's just little things that I can work on in my lunch hour or kind of after work or whatever. And I think that's what you have to do. You have to remember every big project is just a series of smaller projects. And that's kind of what I'm trying to rationalize it with. So
quite a sensible approach, I would say.
Exactly. So this weekend, hopefully I'll break out some screwdrivers and some paint cans and just make little improvements, you know, just little things that make the car more pleasant to look at, to use.
I hope your paint match is more successful than mine.
What about you, Bill? Anything on the horizon?
Yeah, like you, because of Classic Ford shenanigans last weekend, this weekend might be relatively car quiet. I'm sort of trying to keep my powder dry for the Great British Jaguar Day that Chris Harris and Bicester Heritage are running on the 23rd. The Audi TT of mine's been off the road for a month. I basically sawned it at the end of March when the tax came up because I was busy with other things, but I need to get it taxed again. And actually, I want to get it out on the road. I desperately want to get the Quattro bit, the Haldex thing serviced because that hasn't been looked at for absolutely ages. And then I also want to go out and have a look at, there's a car dealer in Henley that I really want to go and have a look at because they've always got some really cool cars. So I'm going to go and have a little mooch around there.
Excellent. Don't spend too much.
So yes, exactly. I'll try and avoid it. Anyway, cars that caught our eye, gentlemen, or cars that have piqued your interest this week, you know, whether that's a type of car or a particular make and model. So Jeff, what's been piqued your interest in the classifieds?
Again, this has been inspired by the next issue of Classic Car Buyer, and it's the we have a buying guide, and it's the original boxy Fiat Panda.
But yes,
I really quite fancy an original boxy Fiat Panda. I remember, again, my dad had a lot of cars, didn't he? But he had an early one, a 1982, and I think by about 1986 it was absolutely rotten in the entry. But there's something quite trendy, isn't there, about a 4x4 or a 4x4 Sizzly? And
yeah,
I just really quite want one, and I've been looking around, and I can't really afford one, in truth.
Great cars.
But if you look on the Slovenian classified site that obviously everyone
as we all do, of course.
As we all do.
You can probably pick one up for about €2,500. I mean, a 4x4 as well. So, you know, it's got to be a video in that.
Coming soon to Classics World.
What about you, Joe?
Well, I will keep this brief. If you watch or listen to this when it comes out on the Friday, this coming Sunday, I drove a car that I was expecting to be good. I didn't expect it to be this good. And that was a Triumph TR3. I drove that car back in mid-February, I think it was. I filmed that video. And I said then, it's early in the year, but this might be my favorite car of the year already. And I stand by that. I would actually have that exact car in the video from our friends at Kim Ken. Sadly, I can't afford it. But it's a TR3A. It's got the rally spec hard top. It's got loads of stickers on it and spotlights, but it's still perfectly usable inside. So it's the perfect hybrid. And you could live out your perfect vintage rallying fantasies in it. And oh, it's just one. Yes. I really want a TR3.
So if you haven't or don't manage to get to watch the TR3 video, do go and have a look at it, because your enthusiasm for it is evident throughout the video.
I may have got a bit overexcited, and at the very end of the video, there may be a little bit of opposite lock coming off a roundabout. That's all I'm going to say.
Excellent. Very good. Well done. Well, I got sort of peeked at cheap Bentleys. You could argue there's no such thing. Even if it's cheap to buy, it won't be cheap to renovate. And I don't know, maybe enough time has passed since we had our Turbo R project car, but I suddenly sort of started to imagine maybe I could justify having a 1980s spec Bentley. And if I didn't quite feel brave enough for a Turbo R, maybe just a Mulsanne or even an 8 would be sufficient, a kind of a luxury barge on the drive. They're not that cheap, but you know, tatty examples are kind of single digit thousand, 6,000, 7,000. You really want to be spending 10 to 15 to get a respectable one. And even then, you probably want to be using it regularly or risk lots of ruinous bills to keep it on the road. But fortunately, my feet were put firmly back on the ground when I sort of said, what do you think if I get one of these? And I showed the Bentley to my wife and she said, absolutely not. They're hideous. So that was my bringing it back down to earth. So maybe I won't get a Bentley just yet. Maybe I need a bit more pounds and pence and some driveway space. But
she wouldn't have said that if you showed her an Allegro a Coupe, that's for sure.
Exactly. Yes, maybe. Well, if another reason, it takes up less space on the driveway. So that would be a better option. But listen, gents, that probably wraps up our weekly chinwag about all things classic cars. Joe, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us on this trip down memory lane as ever. For viewers and listeners, thank you very much for your time. Don't forget to like and subscribe on YouTube or give us a follow and even a review on a podcast platform of your choice. Hopefully it'll help us find many other enthusiasts such as your good selves. But in the meantime, thanks for your company and we'll see you again next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.